welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. And welcome back. We are still going through the Virginia ratification debates, and this is Reclaiming the Republic, and we're almost done. So we'll be able to get into some marketing, some news, and a few other things. And I'm kind of looking at this, and it'll probably take a few more days. I really have no idea how much content there is, because even though it's all kind of highlighted, I'm really only halfway through the ratification debate. So we've got a little ways to go. And some of the insights that we get from this, just like this one coming up, they're painting a very accurate picture of how things were historically. I mean, how they really thought about slavery. And this is a very specific point by George Nicholas as they talk about slavery and the slave trade and so forth in this particular citation. Do not think for a minute that the colonies, when we were creating this Constitution, as a matter of fact, when we went into the Revolutionary War, the majority of the states were already turning its back. You got to remember, because we already read this, that many of the slave states, the southern states, were willing to, you know, free their slaves. Some of them reneged on that, you know, and basically made their slaves come back, or those who they could catch or get. But there were plenty that were promised freedom, and they went to the north because they knew if they were captured by the south, they would be enslaved again. And so the plight of slavery and the abolition movement really started well before 1776 and the Revolution. I would probably look at around 1730s as where the movement really took a hold. And you got to understand, the enslavement of blacks, if you look at slavery in the 1600s, the enslavement of blacks, the official call of enslaving blacks was somewhere around the 1660s, I think 1665, something like that, when King George, or one of the kings of England, basically proclaimed that all the blacks would be slaves, or all the slaves in America would be black, and made sure that they didn't have an interracial slave population. And he did this deliberately. And as a matter of fact, if you look at the history, he even, you know, when they were trying to manipulate the colonies into behaving better, they actually armed and the British actually helped an insurrection of the slaves. I forget which state it was. It may have been Virginia or Carolina. Nevertheless, they were doing this as a matter of a way of controlling, because they started realizing this huge success that they were making in North America. Now, keep this in mind. You have to understand that the other colonies that were established by the other nations, they weren't faring so well. I mean, the Portuguese and the Spaniards, yeah, they took a lot of gold and the riches from the indigenous peoples of the Central and South America, but they weren't having a capitalist type of success like what Britain was. And they saw that these colonies were really growing well. There were a lot of people that wanted to come here. There were a lot of people that wanted an opportunity at a fresh start in life and have the privileges of an Englishman. Where in these other colonies, such as Portuguese, Spain, France, and so forth. And here's the funny thing. France, by the time the New World was being established, somewhere in there, France started abolishing slavery in France. But in their colonies, they allowed it and maintained the practice. And so they were identified as hypocrites because, you know, you're telling us how bad we are, you know, the Britons and these other nations, they're telling them how bad they were for having slaves in their population, But, you know, the fact of the matter was that everybody, even Holland, a nation that did not embrace slavery at that point in time, and I don't think they ever did, Holland allowed anybody that brought slaves with them, they allowed and respected that quote-unquote property and didn't, you know, emancipate the slaves if they came there. They respected the laws of those people who were coming there and who were practicing slavery. Now, didn't mean that a lot of people from North America with their black slaves were going there. No, what was really happening was the slaves from India that Britain had, and or the Slavs from Russia. That was the ideal slave, because they were very large, they were trainable. Apparently, they were the cream of the crop of the slaves. And so, you know, that was the reason why at least Thomas Sowell points to the fact that the word slave was a derivative of the Slavs. Anyway, I'm going too far into this. The fact of the matter is, as we start looking at this, what we understand and how history is being rewritten regarding slavery and this politically correct direction that this country has gone down, it's all incorrect. It's not based on the facts that, you know, the framers were all a bunch of racists. That's not the case at all. And as a matter of fact, anybody that actually does the detailed research, like on Thomas Jefferson, he truly believed, I mean, as a younger man, he thought that blacks were just incapable of having intellectual thought and so forth because of the biases and the indoctrination from the education system. It wasn't until after, I think, before he became president, but while he was in government, he started actually running across brilliant black mathematicians, artists, and so forth, and people of literature. And he's going, wow, I was completely wrong. Anyway, as you know, this show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org as well as RepublicReview.org. And this show is also the only show that's going to give you the evidence of what we need to understand where we are and what we absolutely have to do. I don't know how you're doing right now, because, you know, we're still enjoying good numbers. And usually when I get into this long type of content, because I think people like to have the news cycle, they jones for, oh, come on, let's talk about what's going on with Trump or what's going on with the rhinos in D.C. and how we're getting screwed over by the Republicans. You know what? If you want to know what's going to happen when you elect a Republican, you're going to see progressive policies continue. You are never going to see the turnaround that we need to see until we start actually electing those who are taking a stand on the Constitution. And I'm going to tell you, you'll never find a large crop of Republicans capable of doing that. As a matter of fact, these people are in it for themselves, and that's why there's so many rich people in Congress. And as long as they can think they can get away with being rich and getting rich while they're, you know, supposedly working for the people, they're going to continue to do it. We have to start actually electing, and until people of principle like yourself get involved and decide to start running. You don't run because you want to get rich, because you're going to be called out as a rhino, as a hypocrite, and, you know, a worthless public servant. Anyway, I was trying to wrap this up. Our comment line, 425-270-5416. Now, we're going to get into George Nicholas. He is the one first up. And this is how it starts off. He was wondering that the gentlemen who were against slavery should be opposed to this clause. And he's talking about this clause of ending the slave trade in Section 1, or actually Article 1, I think it's Section 9. As after that period in 1808, the slave trade would be done away. He asked if gentlemen did not see the inconsistency of their arguments. They object, says he, to the Constitution because the slave trade is laid open for 20-odd years. And yet, they tell you, by some latent operation of it, the slaves who are so now well be manumitted. at that same moment, it is opposed for being promotive and destructive of slavery. He contended that it was advantageous to Virginia that it should be in the power of Congress to prevent the importation of slaves after 20 years, as it would then put a period to the evil of complaint, of the evil complained of. And then when he says put a period, put an end to this evil practice of bringing in more and more slaves in the slave trade, end it. And what really happened when America ended the slave trade in importing blacks, well, that didn't mean that they, you know, they weren't exporting blacks out of Africa. As a matter of fact, it did create a market shift. And because the demand went down, I think that maybe the prices actually went down as well, because, you know, supply and demand. But you have to understand that still at that point in time, the Ottoman Empire was still seeking not blacks, but they were seeking the white Slavs, you know, the Ukraine and the Russians. But it was really hard at that point to get them and traverse the land and so forth. So the Ottoman Empire was shifting. And if you read the Thomas Sowell book, I'm taking this aside again, but if you read the Thomas Sowell book, the value of a eunuch, a castrated male, was, you know, 10 to 20 times that of a regular slave. And so as they were, you know, exporting the black slaves out of Africa, they would castrate them. 90% would die, but they didn't care because they were still making more money than they would have out of selling the other nine. It was repugnant. Anyway, we'll be right back. Have you taken the time to watch our presentation on YouTube that provided an irrefutable argument of what we have to do to save our Constitution and our Republic? I know it's over an hour and 30 minutes, but you only need to watch the first 30 minutes. If you take the time to watch this presentation, I promise it will change your paradigm regarding what our Constitution is and what we have to do if we are going to save it, our liberties, our sovereignty, and our republic. We already have answers to most of the questions that you might think of after watching this presentation, and we want to help you get to a point where you have a profound understanding of the audit and republic review process. This is why our bullet overview and flowchart of both the argument and process is available on ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. The sooner you get informed, the sooner you can get involved and make an impact. So go to ReclaimingTheRepublic.org to the Take Action page. That's where you'll find the video. Thank you so much. If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the Republic Review model on ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.
Friends, if you have any questions or comments, we have our 24-hour comment line at 425-270-5416.
Okay, so anyway, let me get back on track here. But I think having a good perspective, and there's nobody that covers this probably better than Thomas Sowell in, I think, a really easily digestible book, which was Black Rednecks, White Liberals. And so if you haven't read that is a treasure trove of historical facts. One of the things he points out is the fact that the racism in America wasn't necessarily caused, but it was a byproduct of slavery and the way slavery was designed by the Brits. So anyway, Mr. Nicholas goes on and says, as the southern states would not confederate without this clause. So you understand. I already told you that the southern states that took the stand against freeing the slaves was Georgia and the two Carolinas. And this is Virginia. Virginia was a southern state where there was still a lot of slavery. And so here he's saying, as the southern states would not confederate without this cause, he asked if gentlemen would rather dissolve the Confederacy than to suffer this temporary inconvenience, admitting it would be such. Now, how badly would it have hurt? Now, I don't know. I don't really understand the interdependencies between the two Carolinas and Georgia, nor did I understand the dependency on Rhode Island. I don't think there was any. As a matter of fact, it seemed like everything was moving fine without Rhode Island. But what would have happened had they said, you know what, we're going to create this union without you. And instead of having 10, they would have had 9 states. Now, what would have happened if the two Carolinas and Georgia was going to be forced into getting rid of slavery? Well, it was already discussed and disclosed that having slaves means that they take a huge risk because the population of slaves themselves will turn against them. They knew this. We read that in the North Carolina debates. And so here you got 3 states that now are going to be outside of the Union because they want to maintain slaves. They want to take on that risk. Well, now they have to risk the dangers of being manipulated by Spain, who's right next to them in Florida, and the Northern Union, who could actually exploit this as well. I don't think that they would have been willingly coming into the Union had the Northern states gone directly after them at this point. But I will tell you, Britain and France would have been there trying to figure out how to, you know, divide and conquer these 3 colonies. And what would have ended up happening was it would have caused the northern states to come down there and free them and then force them into freeing their slaves. It was a risk that I don't think that they were willing to take, because I don't think that they were willing to fight another war. I think that the cost of war wasn't worth at that point in time worth, you know, saving the slaves or ending the slave trade, because it was still being practiced in some of the other states, such as, I believe, Delaware, I believe Maryland, and I believe Virginia and the territories of Virginia, you know, Kentucky and so forth. But the fact of the matter is it would have been, I believe, a huge signal in trying to go after the, you know, the southern states by isolating them and saying, you know what, you guys go ahead and leave the Union. Don't confederate with us. Don't be a part of the Union. And let that play out. I think it would have boded a lot better for American history, and I truly believe that what we're dealing with today and the ill feelings that we have completely harvested between, you know, the way we've all treated each other. And don't be a fool to think it was just the whites. There was hostility on, it's just the same thing with the hostility with the Indians in Roanoke. It was the Indians that were the first ones to actually take hostile actions towards the colonists or those people who were in the settlement of Jamestown. Not Roanoke. Roanoke, they completely disappeared. But Jamestown, I mean, it was during the wintertime when the Indians came and tried to steal their, you know, their food and their animals and so forth, and other hostilities. So the fact of the matter is that when it comes down to that time and those paradigms, people did what they had to do because they weren't as civilized, they weren't as enlightened. And the level of enlightenment to get rid of slavery, it took us a while. It took us 200 years almost. In 1776, and that declaration that all men were born equal, I mean, that was a thought that it woke up the world. That paradigm woke up the world. Anyway, back to Mr. Nicholas. Virginia might continue the prohibition of such importation during the immediate period and would be benefited by it, as a tax of $10 on each slave might be laid, of which she would receive a share. he endeavored to obviate the objection of gentlemen that the restriction on Congress was a proof that they would have powers not given them by remarking that they would only have had a general superintendency of trade if the restriction had not been inserted. But the southern states insisted on this exception to that general superintendency for 20 years. It could not therefore have been a power of implication, as the restriction was an exception from a delegated power. Well, actually, it was a delegated power. It was a restriction for 20 years, and then at that point in time, the federal government assumed the control over who could come into America. And they were the ones who dictated who was, you know, best. I mean, they were the ones that said, okay, we're rejecting immigrants from these lands. And states also had bans on, you know, the importation and or the immigration of different people prior to that and even after that. It's kind of interesting how we had these two layers. Once the federal government started managing the immigration, they didn't allow Mohammedans, they didn't allow non-Christians for quite a while to coming into America, and there were bans. And then when the government started allowing that, and I want to say it was probably the late 1800s, early 1900s, when, you know, and it was well after the communist movement was footed here in America, when they said, you know, we want to create this very diverse melting pot so that we can start dividing and conquering America. Anyway, Mr. Nicholas goes on and says, the taxes could not, as has been or has had been suggested, be laid on so high Negroes as to amount to emancipation, because taxation and representation were fixed according to the census established in the Constitution. The exception of taxes from the uniformity annexed to duties and excises could not have the operation contended for by the gentlemen, because other clauses had clearly and positively fixed the census. Had taxes been uniform, it would have been universally objected to, for no one object could be selected without involving great inconveniences and oppressions. But, says Mr. Nicholas, is it from the general government we are to fear emancipation? Gentlemen, we recollect what I have said in another house and what another gentleman have said that advocated emancipation. Give me leave to say that clause is a great security for our slave tax. I can tell the committee that the people of our country are reduced to beggary by the taxes on Negroes. Had this Constitution been adopted, it would not have been the case. The taxes were laid on all Negroes by the system. Two-fifths are exempted. He then added that he had not imagined gentlemen would support here what they had opposed in another place. So even in Virginia, this whole concept of the proportional or the two-thirds and the three-fifths, not the two-thirds, the two-fifths and the three-fifths, and how that was all laid out on taxation as well as the importation taxation, the $10 per head. You know, all of these things were equally as important in Virginia, and how we can see exactly how these, you know, these men at this point in time chose to address this and chose to look at this. Now, Governor Randolph, much later on, we're going to go into a different, you know, thing here. But anyway, this is what Governor Randolph says. Let me say that, in my opinion, the adversaries of the Constitution wander equally from true meaning. If it would not fatigue the House too far, I would go back to the question of reserved rights. The gentleman supposes that complete and unlimited legislation is vested in the Congress of the United States. This supposition is founded on false reasoning. What is the present situation of the state? She has possession of all rights of sovereignty except those given to the Confederation. It's kind of interesting how they're talking about this new union as a confederation, you see? As a matter of fact, that's why I tell you that that's how they viewed it. Even Jefferson, when he was a president, when he was president, he looked at the nation as a confederacy. He didn't look at it as a, you know, a unified single federation. And so that's why we are actually a hybrid constitutional republic, because we're both a confederacy and a federation. Anyway, she must delegate powers to the Confederate government. It is necessary for her public happiness. Her weakness compels her to confederate with the other 12 other governments. She trusts certain powers to the general government in order to support, protect, and defend the Union. And we'll take a break right there. And when we come back, we'll pick it up as Governor Randolph kind of goes down this path of these restrictions of the federal government and what they can do and what they can't do, and how the states actually have all the power necessary for them to function and be alive. Anyway, we'll get into the bigger picture when we come right back after these two promos.
If you run a business or an organization, you already know email is an essential tool for communicating. If you're interested in reducing your overhead and increasing your productivity, I personally recommend you look into AdLocal email marketing services. AdLocal has a special offer for my listeners with email services that start at $10 a month for your first 1,000 addresses. If you want to increase customer retention, grow your market presence, track your statistics, and improve your engagement with your customers with modern, elegant emails that express the personality of your business with emails that integrate with your website, you need to contact AdLocal, and they handle the rest. Take it from me, AdLocal offers the best solutions for all organization sizes, and they lead with their pricing and the 24-hour customer service. Folks, it's time to call AdLocal at 866-88-ADLOCAL or visit them on the web at www.adlocal.com.
To become a citizen, one must take an oath to support and defend the Constitution. Those of us who are naturally born citizens are obligated and duty-bound to fulfill the same oath, even though we're not required to take it, because it is implied upon us at birth. This is why I cannot emphasize enough the importance in supporting businesses who are supporting our Constitution. We have to stop supporting businesses that have chosen to hide behind political correctness, and obviously we must stop supporting progressive businesses who are working to undermine our republic and our Constitution. Do not let businesses or organizations convince you that they are supporting the Constitution by supporting protests for social justice. By definition, social justice is the distribution of wealth, opportunities, and privileges within a society. In other words, they're calling for socialism, which is incompatible with individual liberty and individual sovereignty and our Constitution. With that, please consider supporting businesses who advertise on this show and this radio station.
Don't forget, you can call our 24-hour comment line to ask a question or to speak on any topic. Dial 425-270-5416.
Okay, so let's be clear here. What were they really delegating the powers to, this general government? They were not delegating the powers of commerce, only that the federal government would be able, or the general government would be able, to regulate and tax the commerce coming in and have the ability to create trade treaties and enforce them with, you know, the commerce both coming in and out. They were not to tax, you know, the state, and they weren't to get their money from the exportation of products. Now, when you look at the system we left, there was a mercantile system that was ran by the Brits. The crown actually told us what to grow and how to grow things. The federal government did not have those powers. They did not get involved in what types of products and what type of industries each state wanted to do. Their only role between the states was to ensure that one state wasn't pitching, you know, some type of economic warfare against the other states. And in essence, we already saw, and we kind of understand at this big level now, that the northern states were free states where there wasn't slave labor, and the southern states were slave labor states. And so the job of the federal government was to ensure that they couldn't create economic disadvantages for either, that they were to make sure that each state had equal footing and equal access to commerce, you know, selling their products and so forth. So really what started to end up happening as the representation in Congress from the abolition states started to increase, what we saw was we saw how the Congress in the 1830s, actually in late 1820s, started going down this path of creating the abominable tariffs, which was punitive types of economic sanctions that were being placed that were hurting the southern states, which is why John C. Calhoun, created this new form and perversion of nullification in going down this, you know, weird path. We'll get into that. But the fact of the matter is that was the beginning, and it just started getting worse and worse because the northern states were actually violating the Constitution. The only course that the southern states had was secession. Why didn't they secede earlier? Why did they wait? And as a matter of fact, here's the interesting thing. Had they seceded years before Lincoln became president, there probably would not have been a civil war. And I am telling you, if you look at Lincoln, Lincoln was a man of failure. He was so accustomed to failing throughout his life that he was so frustrated and in a position where, as president of the United States, there was no way he was going to allow, you know, him to be a failed president. And so this is why he violated the Constitution by not allowing the South to secede and created a war against them. Now, he could have created a war by using the Monroe Doctrine. But the way he went about it, it was like he was constitutionally illiterate. And he did what was best for his image because he didn't want to fail. He finally got things right halfway through. 2 years later, you know, he started making it about slavery instead of it being about an economic war and that you can't leave, that you are enslaved to the Union, that the federal government is, you know, the conquering king, when that is not the case at all. And the fact of the matter is that it, because the southern states didn't leave early, it actually, you know, held everything so that we could, this nation actually finally was able to turn around. Because if you imagine, if the northern states and the southern states divided in the late 1830s or the 1840s, and, you know, they just said, we're out of here, and there was no civil war, there probably would not have been a war to end slavery, that the world would have taken a completely different turn. Had America not gone through the Civil War, had America not sanctified through the sacrifice of blood and, you know, everything that it had to go through to end the Civil War and to end slavery, and it didn't get on that path until, you know, what was it, 1863, 2 years later with the Emancipation Proclamation. But the fact of the matter is that was an epoch of liberty for all mankind throughout the world, because what we did literally shook the world, because we actually became advocates. And I think we worked with Britain to end slavery around the world. Now, the fact is, when you start looking at us, you know, was that meddling? Was that meddling for moral purposes? Either way, when you start looking at how these other nations were managing the slaves, like in Africa and so forth, it was necessary to some degree, but it was not within our power. You know, it was outside the Monroe Doctrine, because Africa, that's not in the Western Hemisphere. So we actually started taking on a kind of an aggressive stance against slavery. Anyway, when we look at, you know, this thing we call slavery and racism in America, it's not necessarily, people aren't looking at the full picture and the big picture. Now, not that I'm actually painting a completely accurate picture with all the nuances and details, but in a general macro sense, this is the truth. Had America not had to go through that civil war and, you know, had paid that price, I don't think we would have been as motivated in trying to help in slavery throughout the rest of the world. Because we went after the Ottoman Empire. We forced all these other nations to stop this slave trade and to try to end slavery. And for the most part, we did. We practically eradicated slavery, just like, you know, we practically eradicated, I believe we did eradicate polio. I believe it's on its way back now. But the fact of the matter is we tried to do the right thing, and we wouldn't have done that had it not been for the Civil War. Had America, you know, things may have been a lot different had America actually not had to go through the Civil War, because we let those three states, you know, had we done that path, who knows what would have happened? Would the world have, you know, shunned slavery? Would we have gotten involved in it? I don't know, but we paid a very high price. And at that point, I think we were pretty motivated in ensuring that no other nation had to necessarily kind of go through that. Anyway, let's move on. Now, is there not a demonstrable difference between the principle of the state government and the general government? There is not a word said in the state government of the powers given to it, because they are general. But in the general constitution, its powers are enumerated. It is not then fairly deducible that it has no power but what is expressly given it. For if its powers were to be general, an enumeration would be needless. But the insertion of the negative restrictions has given cause of triumph. It seems to gentlemen, they suppose that it demonstrates that Congress are to have powers by implication. Now, later on, Hamilton comes down this path of implication. And this is what Governor Randolph says. I will meet them on that ground. I persuade myself that every exception here mentioned is an exception, not from general powers, but from the particular powers there invested. To what power in the general government is the exception made respecting the importation of Negroes? Not from a general power, but from a particular power expressly enumerated. And what was that? And that was the importation of people. It was about the control of immigration. This is an exception from the power given them of regulating commerce. Now, he calls it commerce. But if you look in Article 1, Section 8, the federal government was to have a uniform rule of immigrating and the importation. Now, I can understand how the importation of people coming into the United States would be considered a commerce thing. But I would also consider it also within that immigration thing. But at this point in time, they weren't even looking at blacks as citizens or becoming citizens or being capable of being citizens, because their paradigm, some of these guys' paradigms was just like that. He asks, where is the power to which the prohibition of suspending the habeas corpus is an exception? I contend that by virtue of the power given to Congress to regulate courts, they could suspend the writ of habeas corpus. This is therefore an exception to that power. The third restriction, that a bill of attainder or ex post facto law no ex post facto law or bill of attainder shall be passed. This is a manifest exception to another power. We know well that attainders and ex post facto laws have always been the engines of criminal jurisprudence. This is what we're seeing today, my friends. And the fact is that the government is actually passing these laws that are bills of attainder. Like, what is a bill of attainder? A bill of attainder is passing a law that says a people of a certain class, let's say you don't get vaccinated. Well, now we're going to create this law that, you know, basically creates you and treats you like criminals. That is a bill of attainder. An ex post facto law is saying that something that's legal, and now all of a sudden we say it's illegal, like these electronic vehicles that are going to basically, you know, as of 2030 in California, 2035 in some of the other states, you know, you can't have or can't sell these gas vehicles. Well, it doesn't mean that you can't buy gas and you still can't have a gas vehicle. By going down that path, you've created an ex post facto law that basically outlaws all these other types of vehicles, mandating that everybody must have that. That is an ex post facto law. So, anyway, we'll be right back after these two promos. Thank you so much.
To set the record straight, Republic Review is neither an Article 5 convention nor a convention of states. In accordance with Article 5 of the Constitution, this convention requires two-thirds of the states to apply to Congress to convene a convention with the intent to amend the Constitution. This convention is unable to solve our real problem, which is non-compliance to the Constitution, and would be dangerous to convene at this time. In contrast, Republic Review is the process of the states exerting its constitutional authority over the Constitution. An audit does not require an application to Congress. This authority is inherent to principal stakeholders of a contract. Why do we need Republic Review? Because this is the only way the states can deal with the federal encroachments into roles, responsibilities, and powers that belong to the states. To learn more about Republic Review, please go to reclaimingtherepublic.org to read my content and my model on the audit and Republic Review process. Folks, as you know, online fraud is on the rise, and it's more important than ever for your new and existing customers to be able to determine whether they are using a website with a secured connection. If you didn't know, Google mandated in 2017 that all data submitted to its linked websites must be secure with SSL certificates. Without SSL certificates, your site is listed by Google as not secure. In other words, without these certificates, your site will be harder to find, and this will impact new traffic and ultimately your revenue. Whether you're a blogger or in e-commerce, AdLocal will help protect your website from all forms of data breaches, phishing scams, and build a secure environment for your businesses, big or small. Contact AdLocal by calling 866-88-ADLOCAL or visit them on the web at www.adlocal.com for custom pricing. As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416.
Okay, so we're in this fourth restriction. So these restrictions, by the way, he's going through are the restrictions that we see in Article 1, Section 9. Article 1, Section 10 are restrictions placed upon the states. And you'll find some of these exact same restrictions are placed upon the states as well, such as ex post facto and bills of attainder. I am telling you that they create these passports on those who are vaccinated and those who are not. That becomes a bill of attainder, period. And they're violating the Constitution in so doing. Anyway, the fourth restriction is that no capitation or other direct tax shall be laid unless in proportion to the census before directed to be taken. Our debates show from what power this is an exception to. The restrictions in the fifth clause are an exception to the power of regulating commerce. Now, what is that fifth clause? And I'll read it for you, because this is important, because every time they talk about regulating commerce, you have to understand in what context. The fifth clause in the Section 9, here's a restriction on the, you know, on the federal government. No duty or tax shall be laid on articles exported from any state, which means that they can't get their fingers in creating any types of taxes. So what's a tax? It's a financial burden, or any type of burden placed upon the states. They have no ability to dictate your commerce, what you make, what you can't make, how to make it, and so forth, because that becomes a burden. So a good case in point is environmental standards for California, where the rest of the states are different. Well, that becomes a burden on any car manufacturer that has to make two types of cars. And the fact that the federal government actually supports that and tells these states that they have to support that, that is a restriction placed upon the federal government that they can't do that. That creates an excessive burden placed upon those manufacturers in these other states. Anyway, moving back on through these restrictions, the restriction of the sixth clause, that no money shall be drawn from the treasury, but in consequence of appropriations made by law as an exception to the power of paying the debts of the United States, for the power of drawing money from the treasury is consequential of that, of the paying the public debts. The next restriction restrains any person in office from accepting any present or emolument, title, or office from any foreign prince or state. It must have been observed that though the Confederation had restricted Congress from exercising any powers not given by them, yet they inserted it not from any apprehension of usurpation, but for greater security. This restriction is provided to prevent corruption. All men have a natural inherent right of receiving emoluments from anyone, unless they be restrained by the regulations of the community. An accident which actually happened operated in producing the restriction. A box was presented to our ambassador by the king of our allies. It was thought proper, in order to exclude corrupt and foreign influence, to prohibit anyone in office from receiving or holding any emoluments from foreign states. I believe that if, at the moment when we were in harmony with the King of France, we had supposed that he was corrupting our ambassador, it might have disturbed that confidence and diminished that mutual friendship which contributed to carry us through the war. The honorable gentleman observed that Congress might define punishments from petty larceny to high treason. This is an unfortunate quotation, or the gentleman, because treason expressly defined in the third section and of the third article, and that they are and that they can add no feature to it, they have no cognizance over any other crimes except. Now, we've already heard this a few times, but here we're hearing it again. They have no cognizance over any other crime except piracy, felonies committed on the high seas, and offenses against laws of nations. So piracies, felonies, that's all stuff that's done in foreign water, or water that is not under the control of the United States. Crimes against the, you know, laws of nations, those are crimes that have been committed by a U.S. citizen in a foreign nation. But the rhetoric of the gentleman has highly colored the dangers of giving the general government an indefinite power of providing for the general welfare. I contend that no such power is given. They have power, quote, to lay and collect taxes, duties, imposts, and excise, to pay the debts and provide for the common defense and general welfare of the United States, close quote. Is this an independent, separate, substantive power to provide for the general government of the United States? No, sir. They can lay taxes and et cetera. For what? To pay the debts and to provide for the general welfare. Were not this the case, the following part of the clause would be absurd. It would have been treason against common language. Take it all together and let me ask if the plain implication is not this: a power to lay and collect taxes and etc. in order to provide general welfare and pay debts. In providing general welfare, it's just making sure that each of the states are equally benefiting, not giving specific welfare for the TARP bailouts, not giving specific welfare to the airline industry. There is no power given to the federal government to provide any financial, you know, bailouts. They are required to be uniform in all aspects of how they treat the states. That's a part of this clause. As a matter of fact, let me even go back to this, because this is right here in Section 8. This is the preamble, and this is what they're talking about. To lay taxes, duties, imposts, and excises, to pay the debts, and to provide for the common defense and general welfare of the United States. But all duties, imposts, excises shall be uniform throughout the United States. So this whole point of why they're actually taking taxes, duties, and imposts and excises, well, That's just to benefit the overall United States, to basically pay for our security and to pay for, you know, a war if necessary, not to pay for bad practices by bad businessmen or to bail out the railroad industry in the 1800s. My friends, the intent of this preamble was to basically set the tone, and then every subsection after this preamble clearly delineated how this preamble was to be laid out, specified with these powers. And then in section 9, they defined the restrictions to ensure that these things were not construed within those powers delegated in section 8. So anyway, on the subject of a Bill of Rights, now this is again Governor Randolph, on the subject of Bill of Rights, the want of which has been complained of, I will observe that it has been sanctified by such reverend authority that I feel some difficulty in going against it. I shall not, however, be deterred from giving my opinion on this occasion, let the consequence be what it may. At the beginning of the war, we had no certain Bill of Rights, for our character cannot be considered as a Bill of Rights. It is nothing more than an investiture in the hands of the Virginia citizens of those rights which belonged to British subjects. When the British thought proper to infringe our rights, was it not necessary to mention it in our Constitution, those rights which ought to be paramount to the power of the legislature? Why is the Bill of Rights distinct from the Constitution? I consider a Bill of Rights in this view, that the government should use them when there is a departure from its fundamental principles in order to restore them. This is true, is the true sense of a Bill of Rights. If it be consistent with the Constitution or contain additional rights, why not put it in the Constitution? If it be repugnant to the Constitution, here will be the perpetual scene of warfare between them. The honorable gentleman has praised the Bill of Rights of Virginia and called it his guardian angel and vilified this Constitution for not having it. Give me leave to make distinction between the representatives of the people of a particular country who are appointed as the ordinary legislatures having no limitations to their powers and another body arising from a compact and being certain or and with certain delineated powers. Where a Bill of Rights is necessary in the former, it would not be in the latter. For the best security that can be in the latter is the expressed enumeration of powers. I mean, this was a paradigm shift, folks. This whole concept of what we did in this Constitution by specifically delegating these and only these powers. This is why we do not need a Bill of Rights. And how the Bill of Rights actually became dangerous because we thought, oh, we got these, now we have these protective clauses, when everybody forgot the important fact that we have an enumerated Constitution and only these powers have been delegated and these are the only powers the general government can exercise. Governor Randolph goes on, but let me ask the gentleman where is his favorite rights are violated. They are not violated by the 10th section, which contains restrictions on the states. Are they violated by the enumerated powers? Here, the governor read from the 8th and the 12th articles of the Bill of Rights. And so he goes on, you know, in this, and we'll pick this up in our next episode, of course. But my friends, what kind of evidence do you need? I know we've created a mountain and we're putting the top on the peak here for you. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're reclaiming the Republic and we need your help. God bless.
Folks, I'm constantly providing you with case after case and giving you both the empirical information as well as irrefutable academic evidence that the federal government is operating well outside the bounds of the Constitution. In measuring outlays, the federal government is spending over 80% of your tax dollars on unconstitutional government. This is why we don't need a balanced budget amendment. We just need to enforce the Constitution. So what is it going to take for you to take a stand in getting the federal government back into the framework of the Constitution? To be clear, the solution is simple and does not require much work on any one individual, especially if everyone contributed to the effort. We only ask that you make a commitment today to contributing however you can and make the difference necessary for our posterity's sake. Send me an email at info@reclaimingtherepublic.org and let me know how you'd like to help so we can help you save our republic.